Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today. And our guest is Mark Conlock. He is the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And he'll be talking about the garden and some of the events they have planned for this year. And Mark, of course, will also take your gardening questions, and I hope you'll join in. We always love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you, so give us a call or shoot us an email. And Mark Conlock, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be here, Larry, and with everybody in the state of Wisconsin who is getting excited about gardening in the upcoming months.
I know you guys are getting really excited. The Green Bay Botanical Garden is celebrating 25 years in 2021. And give us a little history. How did it all get started?
Yeah, it's really exciting to be celebrating our 25th year anniversary. We have a lot of great activities planned. We actually have a history book, Larry, that was created a bit ago about the history of the botanical garden. And I like the name of it. It's called A Place for Everyone. So it really is a place for everyone. And the history is there was just a group of people committed to making a garden. It's just a great story of how, you know, a small group of committed people can make a difference in their community. They started in the 1970s kind of having this idea to create a public botanical garden in Green Bay. And you know, they organized, they raised funds, they looked at over 30 different sites of where to put the botanical garden. And it took them maybe, you know, 20 plus years to get everything organized and to get it going. But, you know, we were able to break ground and to start the botanical garden in 1996. And now we're celebrating 25 years. And it's just amazing how much it's grown over the years when you look at some old photographs of the site and, you know, see just the construction in progress. And we're going to be posting a lot of that stuff on our website throughout the entire year. So you can see how it's grown from pretty much, you know, just it was an apple orchard. It was land that the Menominee Nation was on originally, and NWTC, the Northeast Wisconsin Technical College up here. We lease our land from them. And now we're 23 and a half acres of developed gardens and 23 and a half acres of natural area. So it's really amazing the transformation that, you know, a small group of people can do for your community, for your state, and, you know, for your country.
Yeah, and I'm old enough. I was back around back then, and some folks from the garden, there wasn't a garden yet, but they had a fundraiser and a banquet, and they asked me to be the speaker. And I talked about the role of botanical gardens in the 21st century a long time ago, but it was really a lot of fun. And I was so glad if I could be just a really, really small part of getting the garden going. And I expect, I mean, there had to be a lot of difficulty. Money is always probably an issue in raising it. But what were some of the difficulties in going from the idea to the actual garden? It had to take a lot of work.
Yeah, from what I know about it, you know, I was reading the article that we just put on our e-newsletter and looking through the book a little bit. And, you know, it was, I think, a big part of the fascinating part is like looking for the site, you know, where the garden would actually be. That was pretty, you know, pretty big problem, or not a problem, but right, you want to pick the right site. Just like when you're building a garden in your own yard, you kind of think about that site, so important. And then one of the things I learned was, you know, once the site was chosen, the committee, the organization had to raise like $1.4 million to kind of lock it in, from what I understand. So they were able to do that. And the other thing that's so fascinating to me is like how they had this organization and had different events, you know, like what you mentioned, where you were involved, yeah. Probably the garden fair that they used to have down. It was Titletown Brewing Company by the kind of railroad station, you know, to raise money to kind of like get ahead of the game. So they were prepared when the time was right. And probably, you know, just all that preparation and work that goes into it, and, you know, to see it pay off and to be persistent over 20 plus years, right, to be able to do it eventually.
Yeah. And it's really changed a lot over the years. I visited many times, and it fabulous changes.
Yeah, we're so excited about everything going on. You know, probably one of the newest things that people have seen is our grand garden, which was a 2.5 acre addition with an outdoor amphitheater and a concession building and another area for weddings. We're a nonprofit organization, so we do raise all of our money ourselves through memberships, through donations, through all these events that we run. And one of the kind of exciting things, Larry, is we're actually in the process of planning for a 2.5 acre children's garden expansion. And we're working with a company. Yeah, we're working with a company in Madison called Smith Group, our landscape architects and engineers. They've been doing a fantastic job. And we kind of are in the stages of the design development and hoping to wrap that up in the next couple months and present it to our board and think about, you know, raising money to add on to our children's garden and make it pretty exciting, substantial addition for children and families, and make sure we get it, keep it exciting for adults too. So that's a huge addition we're excited about to continue growing, you know, beyond 25 years.
Well, it's great. And the commemorating the anniversary, a lot of special events connected with that, I assume. And
Yeah. We have, you know, we're going to give away something every 25th of the month, some little something. Sometimes it's a plant, sometimes it's a membership. You know, we're kind of incorporating silver plants throughout our plantings, you know, for the silver anniversary. And then we have a big celebration event for the community during our anniversary celebration. And then afterwards, a special event for some of the people that were so involved in creating the botanical garden. And then a lot of cool posts on social media, like I mentioned, and things for everyone to kind of take a look at, you know, to see the history and then to look forward of where we're going to head in the next 25 years.
Well, the 24th year was quite a year for you with the, I'm sure, with the pandemic. It changed a lot. How's it affected the Green Bay Botanical Garden?
Yeah, it was quite a year, right, for everybody. You know, one thing that I think we all learned is just like how important outdoor spaces are to us, and, you know, that we were able to social distance outside and like the solace and, you know, kind of tranquility that botanical gardens, that just natural areas can provide for us in such a stressful time. So that was, you know, something we really learned, and a lot of people were thankful when we were able to open. We closed down for a little bit, and then we were able to open so people could kind of catch the tail end of our spring bulb display, which is a pretty significant endeavor for us. And thanks to a really generous donor and the PPP program and the ability that we had to safely have our Garden of Lights event this kind of last winter, we are in a really good position to continue Green Bay Botanical Garden moving forward. So we're really thankful for everybody that supports us and all of our staff and volunteers who were able to keep us going. So, you know, it's such a community garden in a way, you know, like everyone's been involved in different ways, big and small, and that together is what makes us strong and makes us resilient to get through this time.
Mark Conlock, our guest today, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Questions for him, maybe about the garden, or maybe you've got a plant question you want to bring in. I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. So you've got some silver plants in the offing for this coming year, Mark.
Yeah, Larry, we're trying to, like, every horticulturalist gets to design their areas, and I asked them to put a silver plant in there. There's one, I think it's called Silver Stitch 21, that was like a new helichrysum that we're going to get. And I was looking through, there's a great place called Rush Creek Growers if anyone needs a fix of color to kind of look on their computer. They're one of our wholesale suppliers, so you couldn't buy a plant directly from them as just, you know, a homeowner, but they, it's a really great shot of color to get you enlivened during our winter months. And I saw a couple cool silver plants on there. There's one Colchester White that we use a lot. And there's, you know, the good old cardoon, which is kind of like a type of artichoke that has the really nice silver foliage. So if you check out that website, you'll see a lot of cool things as you peruse through there. And, you know, it's interesting to try to weave a silver plant into your design. And, we also have this exhibit called Washed Ashore. So I asked the horticulturalist to kind of put some blue, you know, watercolored plants into their design. So it should be really interesting for visitors to find those plants throughout the garden.
Oh, it sounds great. And you have a traveling exhibit at the gardens, do you not? Tell us about that.
Yeah, Larry, that's this a traveling exhibit called Washed Ashore, which is art created with like debris that's washed up on ocean shores. And mostly the debris is like, you know, I want to say trash or garbage. It's cleaned up, obviously, but it's kind of unique. There's 8 really humongous sculptures that are made to kind of talk about, you know, what's going on with oceans, you know, what we can do to make a difference, you know, in the world and keep things a little bit more cleaner and more, you know, recycling, sustainability. And the kind of the other really cool part about the exhibit here is we're going to showcase Stanley the Sturgeon, which is a new sculpture that the artist is making out of debris collected from the Great Lakes. So it's a way that we can tie, you know, the fact that this exhibit's a lot about oceans, but, you know, we're on such a huge, important freshwater, you know, system of water that we can talk about, you know, what we can do in our own backyard to be better stewards of that resource.
Let's take a call. Val in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Val.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say I work at the Technical College, and we're partners with the Botanical Gardens, and they are awesome partners. And I'm able to teach some of my classes in sustainable food and agriculture right in the Botanical Gardens. My question is, if you know how many other botanical gardens in the state or maybe the country have partnerships with colleges where on a routine basis students are able to access all the really cool stuff you're doing at the gardens.
Awesome. Thanks, Val. I love Val. I know her well. She's a great partner to Green Bay Botanical Garden, and we love partnering with her in the programs at NWTC. You know, Val, when we were writing this book and when I first started at Green Bay Botanical Garden, which is 2005, you know, what I learned or heard was that this is the only partnership in the country where there is a botanical garden and a 2-year technical college associated together is like kind of one partner organization. So that is definitely a thing that makes Green Bay Botanical Garden and NWTC, you know, unique.
Well, that is really cool. Val, thanks so much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. A couple of emails, a listener emailed that her brother lives in Spokane with Manitou Park, a beautiful garden. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but it is a beauty. I haven't visited, but seen online. Lisa in Exonia emailed that she loves the hosta gardens at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, especially the one with the King's series. So you better describe that for us, Mark. It is beautiful.
Yeah, we have the Green Bay Botanical Garden is an American Hosta Society display garden, like the entire garden. And we have the Green and Gold Hosta Society. We partner with a lot of groups. Again, the community garden idea, where a lot of these plant groups help us take care of, donate plants and manage the areas that, you know, would be hard for us to do without their help because we'd need so much more staff. So there's really the Green and Gold Hosta Garden, which is an amazing collection of hostas in the front right when you first come into the garden. It's actually like in our parking lot right by NWTC's landscape horticulture building. And then the other area that has a lot of hostas that people love is the King Shade Garden. And that's the area with that springhouse ruin that kind of shelters it from the children's garden. It's right across from there. Yeah. And then it has what I love about it is it has hostas mixed with other shade perennials, mixed with shade tolerant shrubs and trees. And that gives you like some really great ideas of what you can do in your own landscape to kind of mix all those things together or work with what you have to add hostas or other shade tolerant plants. And we have hostas then sprinkled all through other parts of the gardens too. So now, hostas are such a versatile plant and people love all the attributes they bring. So we use them all over as well.
Yeah. Mark Conlock, our guest from the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Again, questions for him, join in 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. taking a look at the Green Bay Botanical Garden and also answering some questions today with our guest, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. I hope you'll join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you've even got a comment about the garden itself. Before we get back, I wanted to mention about an event, a virtual garden tour, where you're going to be able to ask gardening experts your questions, start planning your garden, and you'll do it at PBS Wisconsin's Garden and Landscape Expo. It's free. It's online February 20th and the 21st. So from your own screen at home, you can dream of springtime blooms. And all guests who register by January 31st, which is coming up pretty quickly here, if you register by January 21st, 31st, you will have the chance for a virtual meet and greet with me. We'll, I don't know if that's a prize or not, but at least you'll have a chance to do that. You can ask me pretty much anything about myself or about the station or about Garden Talk, and I'll do my best to answer those questions for you. So register now for a chance to win that opportunity, just a personal meet and greet with me virtually. Go to Wisconsin Garden Expo or wigardenexpo.com and register now, and then you'll get a chance to go in. I think we're going to be a few people who are going to be picked, and 15-minute or so conversation with me virtually, and I'm looking forward to it. So I hope you are too, and of course the garden tour is going to be absolutely great, as is the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And Beverly in Bayfield has a question for us, so let's go there. Beverly, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I've been reading some books by Diana Beresford Kroger, who knows a lot about trees. And then she mentions the pawpaw tree, which I had heard of a long time ago. And I was wondering if the botanical garden contains or would consider planting one of those trees.
Pawpaws you're talking about. Okay. Well, Mark, what do you think?
You know what? This question is right up my alley, because when I went to school at UW River Falls, I went back to school there after being a civil engineer and graduating from Madison, side note, and I had to do a paper, like I kind of got out of this fruit class, but I had to do the labs and I had to do my special project for my overall degree had to be on fruit. So I actually did it on commercialization of the pawpaw in the United States. Why you don't see the fruit so much, because it has a really short shelf life. But I really became enamored of this plant. And we actually have two really large specimens of pawpaw in our herb garden. They're kind of like in a little microclimate where they're on the south side of that building. So they are able to collect that extra heat because they're kind of like a zone 5 plant, but they have been successfully grown by us for a long time. And then we have a lot of other cultivars of pawpaw that we have planted over the years in other spots of the garden. And we've actually collected pawpaw fruit. We've gotten pawpaw fruit off of them and collected the seeds and grown those as seedlings and given plants away and everything. So I would definitely say it's worth trying. It is a zone 5 plant, so look for a little microclimate if you're in a colder area. But our winters here in Green Bay have been, you know, fairly mild. Like, we haven't had a zone 4 winter really since I've been here, unless there's been maybe one time recently. But previously, negative 19 was our low. So yeah, it's a great plant. And it is at a lot of other botanical gardens. I know I'm getting crazy long on this answer, but the Olbrich has some, and Berner Botanical Gardens has a pawpaw patch. And it's really just an interesting thing because it is the largest tree fruit native to like the lower 48 states. And it has that tropical look of the leaf, and it's pollinated by flies in the springtime. And its fruit kind of look like, or the flowers, I mean, are like kind of meat looking and, you know, carrion pollinated by the flies. So you actually, what you might want to do if you get some is have a little Q-tip where you transfer pollen between the different plants, because you need two different plants to produce fruit, and that's one of the issues of why pawpaw isn't, you know, sold in grocery stores and commercialized, because it's really hard and interesting to get it to be cross-pollinated, because it flowers earlier in the spring, the flies pollinate it, and it's susceptible to frost and things like that then. So really great plant. Try it out for sure.
There you go, Beverly. Although Bayfield might be a little tough. Temperatures,
yeah, probably. That's
buddy of mine up there in that area showed on Facebook a picture of 28 degrees below zero on his thermometer. So like, it could be an issue there, Beverly. But, hey, take a look at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. The visit over there, you're going to see some really nice pawpaws. Well, Deb in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that Green Bay Botanical Garden, I've been there. It's just absolutely wonderful. And that in Wausau, we actually have a botanical garden. It's not as old as Green Bay, about 10 years old, 12 years old. But I have to say that the garden does work and has been involved from the very, very beginning with, now it's UW-Stevens Point, Marathon County. So, and they have a lot of educational things going on. I'm not on the board of the university anymore or the botanical garden, but I do know that even in the master plans, there's room for buses, and there's always educational things, and they work and coincide with the university there. So botanical gardens are just fabulous for all that kind of educational community togetherness.
Well, Deb, I thank you so much. The Monk Gardens, gardens in Wausau, and with a connection to the UW. So that's great to know, Mark.
Yeah. I love Monk Botanical Gardens. We've been there quite a few times, and actually took a bus trip from Green Bay Botanical Garden to visit there. And they have, you know, been growing and expanding, like you said. And they have a really cool pavilion there that has like an outdoor kitchen, and it looks out over their community gardens where they have some really nice vegetable plots growing. And I know they were working on a pretty significant hosta collection the last time I was there. So it's really exciting. And, you know, Larry, I wanted to mention, like, you know, I think it's probably on the PBS Wisconsin website from the Garden Expo last year, but I gave a talk on public gardens of the state of Wisconsin. So I think I've mentioned Monk Botanical Gardens in there. So it's really cool to see some of those pictures of those different gardens in a way to travel around the state if you can't right now because of everything going on.
Yeah, Deb, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you've got a plant question, maybe a question about the gardens, or maybe an experience to share as well. We certainly always look forward to them as well. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You actually have an event this Saturday, don't you, Mark?
Yeah, Larry, we have this winter celebration event, and it's actually free to the public, so it's a really good time to visit the garden. Of course, it's winter, but you can walk around, and, you know, there was going to be snowshoeing, but we don't have enough snow in the Green Bay area, actually, to snowshoe effectively, so we have outdoor hikes, a scavenger hunt. We'll have an activity that people can take home with them, a craft activity. And it's supposed to be pretty good weather around here, actually, you know, like maybe 30-ish degrees, so it won't be extremely cold. And there is snow predicted, but it's not till a bit later in the day or evening. So it would be a great time to get outside, get some fresh air, a good activity to be socially distanced and safe from everybody, but still get out and enjoy the great outdoors and see some plants in their kind of winter form and glory at that time of the year.
Yeah, it's a beautiful time of the year to visit, just to see what those plants look like in the winter. Some of them, I mean, you know, in my own little garden, I like to just keep I don't clean the garden out, the flower garden out. I let it be, and it looks pretty darn nice in the wintertime with the snow on it and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We like to enjoy that too. And, you know, what kind of Laird, we did an interesting thing this last year where we, in the Grand Garden, we actually left, we tried to leave it up more because of all the native plants in there and how insects overwinter on them. So we left half of it up, but half of it, we actually, instead of like cutting the plants and like taking them away to our compost pile, we actually took our hedge trimmers and like cut them 3 or 4 times into little pieces and just let them filter down onto the ground to see if they could be like, you know, a living, or not living, I guess they'd be cut now, but like a mulch, you know, without, instead of putting wood chips, or instead of removing all that plant debris, letting that recycle back in, kind of like Roy Diblick and others have advocated for. So it's like an experiment on a grand scale we're going to try out, where we could do the same thing in the springtime. So you could enjoy everything in winter for winter interest, but then instead of removing all the debris, kind of cut it into little pieces and let it become, you know, the mulch.
And Roy's not a big fan of wood chips.
No, Roy doesn't like the wood chip environment. Very unnatural. Yeah, so I'm listening to him.
Oh, yeah. And maybe talk for a second about why he, you know, why he doesn't, and why he looks to other kinds of ways of working in the garden.
Yeah, well, you can add what you know, Larry, because you probably know more than I do. But from my conversations with Roy, he always likes to say that, you know, what ecosystem out there is there 3 inches or more of wood chips across, you know, which is really none. And he, you know, likes to talk about how plants have really evolved, you know, by kind of like living in their own litter over time as it decomposes and breaks down. That's what provides them, you know, their nutrients that they need. And it keeps the mulch from being by the base of the plant, which leads to moisture being held up, which leads to rot issues or insects and disease kind of at the base or crown of the plant. So those are some of the things that I know he explains about why it doesn't seem to make sense. And it's kind of just a thing that we as humans have put upon plants versus how they're naturally growing.
And I, at the first time I talked with him about that, I was thinking about the wood chips I had in my own garden. And I've gotten rid of most of those. And sort of the English approach where you try and let all the plants get together and just you're full of plants and there's no room for the weeds to get in. And
yeah.
Well, I tell you what. Rob emailed to ask, or here we are talking about mulch, and Rob emailed to ask what kind of mulch, if any, do you use in the garden?
Yeah, so as we were talking about not using it.
we go ahead and use it anyway.
Yeah, we still do use a lot of it, honestly, because it just is efficient to cover the soil for all the things we talk about typically, right? To kind of maintain and hold moisture in the soil, to suppress weed growth. And it's a good way, I think, maybe still like when you're first starting a garden before those plants get big enough to do all those things and get close in together. So we use like a shredded hardwood mulch typically that we actually buy it in semi loads. So typically we'll have 3 semi loads of 80 cubic yards. So a huge, huge amount of mulch, but we have, you know, reduced it a little bit to 2 semis last year.
That is that's another point. I think you're not out there all by yourself putting that, getting that mulch spread around. You've got a host of volunteers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, for sure. It's a huge amount of people. Like it takes a village of gardeners. So we have our staff. We have 8 full-time year-round staff in our horticulture and facilities department. And then we usually have about 5 garden interns. And then we have all of our huge cadre of volunteers, like literally probably 100 in the hort department that help us, but a few groups of really dedicated volunteers that come Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays of maybe, you know, 30-ish people that are pretty regularly coming every week to help us do all that work. So not only the mulching, but, you know, like a lot of the, obviously the weeding, the planting, the deadheading, because we really don't use any herbicide except for with invasive species control typically. So all of our weeding is really done by hand. So it's really quite sustainable, but it is a heck of a lot of work, and it takes all those volunteers to be able to do it like that.
Especially when you got an acreage like you've got, for sure. Veronica in Johnson Creek emailed that she has, here we go to pawpaw trees. She has a pawpaw tree, trees. She mentions trees, plural, but can't get them to produce fruit. She has flowers and even tried pollinating with a paintbrush, but didn't have any luck. What else could create a problem?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think she's doing everything right. So, I mean, she'd want to make sure that the flowers are receptive to pollen. You know, what I noticed one time was, you know, the flower is very far along when you can actually get the pollen off of the anthers. So maybe just make sure you're doing it a bunch of different times throughout the season when those plants are flowering. And then the other thing I noticed was it took us a number of years to get the fruit. Actually, I would notice little fruits on there, but they would abort for some reason or another. So, you know, just keep trying, I would say, and try to do it a bunch of different times throughout the flowering season to be more likely to have a flower that's receptive to accepting the pollen so that you get fruit, and then kind of monitor it and see if you can get them. Oftentimes we'll also have, you know, like chipmunks or other animals will knock that fruit off, you know, before it's mature or even possibly when it's really small. And that might be the reason why in the Green Bay Botanical Garden, it's not been eventually it worked over years, but it took a while, you know, so just be patient, I guess, and keep trying it. Like I said, a couple times throughout the flowering season.
I want to take a check on what you guys experienced this past year in a few different areas. One area is in the disease area. Were there any specific problems that you guys had and maybe how you dealt with them?
That's a really good question. I really can't think of like a disease problem, you know, that we had that was really spectacular, which is a good thing, obviously, but it doesn't allow much to talk about. But, you know, I really can't think of anything off the top of my head that was, you know, actually there is one thing that we noticed maybe 2 years ago, and this year we've been working on it, is we did notice for the first time magnolia scale on our collection of magnolias, you know, which is a significant collection. It's the only plant collections network through the American Public Gardens Association in the state of Wisconsin. And it's about 120 plus different kinds of magnolias from Dennis Ledvina, the local hybridizer, internationally famous. So it's a really thing that we keep monitoring. So we just noticed them for the first time 2 years ago, and we actually literally hand-picked them off and took like a razor blade to scratch them off gently without damaging the cambium and used like rubbing alcohol. And then the next year we noticed them, you know, as well. So we looked into like a systemic insecticide to use on those trees because we don't want that to become a problem because it's such an important collection, especially with cold hardy magnolias.
Well, and scale, just in general, scale is the worst. I'm telling you, for indoor houseplants, dealing with scale is, I mean, is that the way to do it? Sit there with a razor? I mean, are there, you know, for some people, you got to be pretty good at doing that if you're not going to, you know, really damage the leaves. What is the best way to control scale on indoor plants?
Well, I think probably what you can do, what we do at the Botanical Garden on some of our interior plants, is we kind of just like use a little rubbing alcohol solution and, you know, rub them off of there. One thing I did hear for the magnolias is that you can use horticultural oil, you know, at the right time of the year, probably earlier in the season, to like suffocate the little crawlers that come out from the scale. So that's like a bigger solution. You could probably use something like that on a plant inside too. But like Q-tips too, sometimes we'll dip the Q-tip in the alcohol and kind of use that to squish the scale off of there. I remember I had a bay leaf tree back when I was an engineer. I was into the plants and I had a lot of herbs. And that darn bay leaf tree was the scaliest thing. And that's where I first learned about scale, because I was like, what are all these little brown things? And then they get all sticky and the honeydew and the, you know, it just became too much like of a thing, like you said. So the other option you have is if it's not a plant that you're emotionally attached to, you might be better off throwing that thing in the dumpster and getting a new one instead of having to do all the work of, you know, taking the scale off of it. That's what happened to mine eventually.
Stan emailed to ask for suggestions for plants to put on the strip between his sidewalk and the road. It gets a lot of afternoon sun. So what are some good ideas for that area? And there are obviously lots of those areas.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think a lot of times they call those things like the hell strips because they're between the, between the different paved areas and get really hot. So there's some, a lot of times, you know, like native plants will work good in there because they're used to our conditions. Some of the plants, I think a lot of the plants that we've used in our grand garden would be pretty useful in that. And I've thought about it in the past, like there's one called Allium Millennium. That's an allium. It's not a native plant, but it's quite quite hardy and can probably take those conditions. There's Montrose White Calamint or Calamintha nepeta, subspecies nepeta. That's like the perennial plant of the year. And Calamintha Montrose White is a selection of that from W.N.E. Radke Nursery down in Menominee Falls. So that's like a bulletproof plant. We grow it along our sidewalks and it blooms like June through September. And it's a magnet for pollinators. I would also think like some of the shorter, you know, prairie grasses you could use in there, like Spirobolus, prairie drop seed, little blue stem, side oats grandma, to give you a different like texture and look in there, and the seed heads into the fall. And what else was I thinking? Oh yeah, the other thing I thought maybe that you, if you can get established, would be Asclepias tuberosa, like butterfly milkweed. You know, because that would be a good butterfly pollinator plant with the monarchs being in decline, and it can take, you know, pretty dry conditions. There's one called that's specifically for clay. If you have clay soil from Prairie Nursery, like a variety selected for growing in clay. And I would take a look at a lot of those short growing native plants, too, that you might be able to put in there, because then you'll have not only the beautiful garden, but you'll have some, you know, habitat that you're creating. One quick thing I would mention is just think about the height of the plants, perhaps, though, because you may not want to have a really super tall thing that could obscure, you know, views, especially if it's like around a corner or something like that for other traffic issues. So you might want to look into that too before you plant something too tall.
Yeah, that's right. I know I'm like Stan. I've got a situation like that too. But I went with the natives. You know, I've got some little blue stem and some of the plants you just mentioned. And it looks great, and it looks great all year. I mean, it's sitting out there now. I didn't clean it out because I wanted the insects and so forth to have a place to stay, and it provides some nice winter interest, I think. And it's beautiful when it's when things are blooming. It looks absolutely great. So. Well, I tell you what, you can join in too. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us with your garden question at ideas at WPR.org. My guest today, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, having fun talking with him, and hope you join in as well. Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Questions for him? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email at ideas at WPR.org. And let's take a call. Andrea in Green Bay will give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I literally live right behind the botanical garden, so my backyard butts up against there, and we share a deer and wild turkey population. I was just wondering if they wreak havoc upon any of your gardens.
Oh, deer would be bad.
You know, the wild turkeys don't do a lot of damage. They're pretty fun to watch, but we have, you know, they've scratched up a couple of things, but I haven't noticed like significant damage from the turkeys. The deer, on the other hand, you know, have become a bit of a problem. Like, we used to not have very many, but over the last, I'd say, 4 to 5 years, we usually have three of them kind of inside the fenced area. And then there's the ones on your side of the fence, which is a lot more than our inside the fence. We try to scare them out, but it's pretty challenging. So what we've actually had to start doing is putting burlap around some of the conifers that they like to eat, like specifically the white cedar, the Thuja occidentalis, and the yews, the taxus species. We've had to start burlapping those in the winter months because otherwise they have, you know, eaten them up so much, like, you know, they do all over the place, and at other botanical gardens, it can be a challenge as well. And then we do plant, use liquid fence as a deterrent to deer and rabbits eating our plants, specifically our tulips, because we have a huge amount of spring bulb displays. Like, our tulips, we plant 45,000-ish tulips and daffodils every fall to augment our spring display of over 300,000 spring blooming bulbs. So we actually spray the ground after we plant them until the ground freezes. And then in the springtime, every week, we spray all the tulips with liquid fence to keep the deer from eating them. So that's some of the things that we've had to do over the last couple of years to prevent them. And kind of an interesting story, when I first started at the botanical garden, I remember my second interview walking around the garden, and like literally half of the tulips were eaten by deer. And I was kind of like, I never want that to happen if I get this job and I work here at Green Bay Botanical Garden. So it's like a thing that I'm always like, oh my God, the deer have eaten some of these tulips. We have to get on this. I don't want it to look like the second time I was ever here.
And so it does, it is pretty effective, the liquid fence. You got to keep at it, I would think.
Yeah, the liquid fence is, for us, it has been, you know, other people have mentioned other products like deer skid and things like that. We do spray it every week, though, you know, so like on the bottle, it says to spray it, you know, once, or and then maybe the next week, and then you can wait 3 to 4 weeks. But we actually use it weekly. Is there anything you do, Andrea, to keep them away?
Well, I don't have a garden, but we there's actually two buck and four doe that we see regularly. And they actually come right up to our living room window and eat off of the trees. And it hasn't been that much of a problem. I just thought with, you know, all the vegetation that you have, you probably see a whole lot more.
Yeah,
but the fence helps a little bit. The fence helps a little bit. Andrea, thanks a lot for calling. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. See, the sun is shining really bright here. But you know what? I have this Christmas cactus, and I got two flowers off of it this year, but I think maybe the problem is because right across the street from my house is a street light, and that thing has got lights on all year long. You know, I was so happy that the bulb burned out for a while, but then I got two little bulbs off my Christmas cactus. But what are you supposed to do, cover those things all up with plastic or something black so they don't get any light at night, or what's the deal?
Larry might know more than I do, but I think the Christmas cactus, you know, it might be more of a, it flowers with like cool and like dry. Isn't that the case, Larry?
Yeah. Cool and dry, and I've had great luck with them because I am one of these people who just ignores plants a lot of times, and I don't fertilize either. You know, you want to keep them a little shy on the fertilizer, a little shy on the water, and cooler, which typically isn't, for most homes, it's not a bad, you know, it's, most people don't keep their homes 72 degrees in the wintertime. It's a little cooler in the evening. It's going to work a lot better for you. So that's what, and the light, I'm not sure about the light. The one I had in my office, there was the light was off. Maybe if you had a curtain there that you could just put up or close at in the evening, it might help, Nancy. So that's another, I think it's another thing, just to cut the amount of light that you're getting in there. Anyway, kind of ignore it. Don't fertilize it. Don't water it too much. And keep it cool, and you're probably going to have better luck. Mine bloomed, it seemed like, all year round. Thank you. Carol in New Richmond, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a daughter in Sheboygan, and I just wanted to give a shout-out to two gardens there. One is the Storybook Gardens, Bookworm Gardens, which is a nonprofit organization, and that's really nice, especially for children. And then the other one is one that we had the privilege to tour. They had a community event, but it is a private garden called Christopher Farm and Gardens, and that is absolutely, if you ever get the opportunity, it is outstanding. Thank you.
And where is it, Carol?
Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
In Sheboygan.
Yep, both in Sheboygan.
Okay. All right. Mark, do you know those gardens?
Yeah, definitely. Bookworm Gardens is a great children's garden and garden for everybody, too. And they've been doing some additions. There's like a large bridge that was put in maybe a couple years ago to kind of connect and help some of the circulation routes through it. And it has a really neat ruin garden that's like an outdoor kitchen and kind of almost like a little stage area. So that's really exciting. And Christopher Farms and Gardens is a great place. It's owned by Jay Christopher. And I think him and his wife kind of were involved with or started the founders of Pampered Chef. And you can visit that garden through this event that I think probably was canceled last year because of COVID, but it's called Junapalooza. So if you look up Junapalooza, it's a fundraiser for Meals on Wheels of Sheboygan County. And it's a way that you can then be able to visit that private garden, which I'm pretty sure is significant, like 60 acres, I want to say. And it's a really spectacular place to check out. It has some really interesting hardscaping features, and it's just on a grand scale. And it has a lot. One thing I've noticed about Christopher Gardens that is something that people could use in their own yard is like repetition of plants. There's just like, you know, huge masses or a similar plant used in many places throughout the grounds to kind of like help tie a larger property like that together. So that's like a little design thing that I noticed in the probably four or so times I've been there.
Good points, Carol. Thank you so much. Kent in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Kent.
Hi. I've read that in Wisconsin and actually throughout the world, soils have been depleted in carbon and fertility because of years of factory farming, overgrazing, overuse. And I was wondering if you know of any demonstration farms and yards that practice regenerative agriculture and regenerative gardening and yards.
Mm-hmm. Mark, familiar?
I'm trying to remember the name of the garden in Walworth County that does some of the, I think that, you know, I can't remember the name of it off of the top of my head, but I think it would be a good example of it. I'll have to look at that and get it to you. But I know that one thing that a lot of people can do in their own yards, you know, is add organic matter and compost to their gardens to help, you know, renew the soil properties, water holding capacity, and that kind of thing. And also maybe like we talked about before where we said, you know, don't remove the plant debris, but kind of let it be there so that you're letting all that matter become part of the soil. But that is a huge thing of like, you know, say conventional farming versus no-till farming versus smaller agriculture and things where people are buying their food from farmers markets and things like that, where they know more about the farm and what they're doing, their practices. You know, they're green manuring or using cover crops that help hold the soil in place and then tilling those in there so that the nutrients aren't just always being harvested and taken away. In a strange way, I think about it with our garden, actually, because, you know, we're growing these annuals and we usually pull them out. We have bulbs and we pull them out. So, you know, adding that compost is something we try to do. Because instead of harvesting like, you know, corn or soybeans, we're harvesting tulips and annuals all the time. So it is definitely something to consider in your garden.
And Kent, you might want to take a look. You could go online to the University of Wisconsin or UW Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. It's CIAS is the acronym for it. So UWCIAS. And they're tuned in to some of what you're, probably a lot of what you're talking about. And I would recommend you go to their website, the Center for Integrative Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison, or type in UWCIAS. It might pop up that way as well. But I know they are certainly interested in that area that you're talking about, CIAS, Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. Well, our guest today is Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Always fun to talk with him about what's going on in the garden. Man, it's celebrating 25 years this year. I hope you'll go online to their website, too, Green Bay Botanical Garden, and type in, and you'll see all the events and so forth that are taking place at the gardens. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Our guest is Mark Conlock. He is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And we've been answering your gardening questions and talking about the garden. And I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about the garden or maybe about your own plants? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And see, Genevieve in Bondiwell is online with a call. Let's go there. Hi, Genevieve.
Hi, Larry and Mark. How are you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. A previous caller asked Mark about regenerative agriculture and sustainable agriculture or farming practices. And funny enough, that's actually a program offered by NWTC, which is in conjunction with the Botanic Gardens. That's taught by Valerie Dantoin, who actually called in earlier. So I just thought to drop that note for that caller if they're still listening.
Very good. Mark?
That is awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I should look at their curriculum more, I guess, right?
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Thanks, Genevieve. Appreciate it very much. Somebody else also mentioned that the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute is a place to go for more information as well. So it's worth that. But there you got it right in your own backyard, Mark. There we go. Well, Rory, I'm sorry, in Whitewater wants to know if your garden, the botanical garden, grows any of your own plants. And if you do, do you grow any from seed?
Yeah, great question. We actually grow probably 25,000 annuals from seed. And we actually use the technical college's greenhouses to grow them from seed ourselves. And we have a couple hoop houses that we fill up with the plants as they mature, and we have to step them up to the next size pot. And then we grow probably 10,000 plants where we buy the plugs wholesale and then put them into a container with soilless media and grow them. And then the rest of probably our 5,000 annuals we buy as plants from that Rush Creek supplier that I mentioned to you. And then we buy our perennials and trees and shrubs. And all that stuff we set up wholesale accounts so that we can buy the plants mostly and the seeds to an extent and the plugs, at prices that are less expensive to be stewards of the funds at Green Bay Botanical Garden. So it was kind of one of the things we did back in the day 15 years or so ago, so that we can set it up so we can grow a lot of unique and different things that we might not be able to get locally. So that's kind of an exciting thing for us to look through all those catalogs. And it's always that miracle to grow things from seed, right? We've actually, if you check out our Facebook page, I'm pretty sure they have like the first seedlings have been up for a couple weeks already. So we really start stuff in January, especially for our spring containers like pansies and begonias and things. Begonias take a long time to grow from seed. So it's pretty much a whole other side of our operation kind of behind the scenes, but we love it because it gets us a chance to be, you know, intimately connected with those plants from a little seed all the way for them as being a mature plant in our garden.
Great question. And Rory, thank you so much. Let's go to Cal in Sugar Camp next. Hi, Cal.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about whether anybody is breeding native plants to either be, you know, more flowers or more compact or different colors without losing the pollen and nectar benefits that we look for in native plants.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a pretty controversial topic, shall we say. But the person that comes to the top of my head is Brent Horvath of Intrinsic Perennials, like in Hebron, Illinois. He's been doing a fair amount of work with that, and I'd say he's one of the spearheading breeders in the country on that, where he has been selecting seedlings of native plants and finding ones that he likes the characteristics of better. Like you said, maybe it's more compact, so it's more likely for a person to put it into their landscape and keep it there. Or maybe, you know, like sometimes it has different color of a foliage of a grass, especially. So I want to talk a little bit about it because I had to do a presentation. I didn't have to. I did a presentation for the wild ones where I investigated and learned about a lot of the studies. So Doug Tallamy, who wrote that book, Bringing Nature Home, has done some investigation of this at the Mount Cuba Center. And, you know, the gist of what he found was that if you think about it, a lot of insects, you know, there's all the pollinators that we always think about, but a lot of insects eat the leaves of plants. And that's like the basis of the food chain. So one thing as gardeners is we have to be tolerant of insects eating some of our plants. This one guy, Jack Pizzo, calls it the 12-step program. If you step back 12 paces from your plant, if you don't notice the holes, then just live with the damage because it's providing habitat in the food chain. So what he found, what Doug Tallamy found in his studies is that the only thing that made a significant difference in like less insects using a plant was if it had purple foliage. So the anthocyanins that make the foliage purple, like the insects don't like to eat that for whatever reason, or maybe it's toxic to them. So that's like kind of a biodiversity or like another characteristic to consider when choosing your plants, right? From that study, it showed that purple leaved plants wouldn't be as good as a habitat plant for insects than either green or even variegated foliage didn't affect it. And then there has been some studies of Jennifer White at the University, I want to say of Vermont, on looking at all different kinds of plants and like nativars in deciding, you know, whether they had the same pollinator value. And the Mount Cuba Center, that would be a really good place for you to look because they have some really good research. And Chicago Botanic Garden is doing a nativars research project. So the thing that they found is that in general, a native plant, you know, is better than the nativars in terms of pollinator value. But sometimes it's not so clear cut. Sometimes there's been one case where the cultivar actually had more pollinators than the nativar had more than the native straight species. Sometimes it's very similar. You know, sometimes in the Chicago Botanic Garden study, they found like a larger diversity of pollinators on a nativar than the native species. So it gets a little bit complicated, but, you know, probably in general, if you pick the native species, you're safe and you're going to be providing habitat for the insects that it evolved with, you know, but it gets complicated. So it's kind of a big topic that I probably talk too darn much about right now. But just so you know, there's some really great research at the Mount Cuba Center in Delaware and Chicago Botanics nativar study that you should take a look at.
Yeah. Cal, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. That, I can see where that would be controversial, this whole business of nativars.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, Larry, that I didn't get into that makes me make, we have it on a sign in our grand garden, actually, is a landscaper talked about how he created a bunch of gardens like this, you know, native gardens. But what happened was the next homeowners thought of it as like a weed patch and just destroyed it. So one of the other things to think about in terms of native plants is like maybe incorporating them into your garden, you know, in a more organized fashion as a way to have those plants last longer in time to make a benefit to habitat and biodiversity. You know, so it's like a melding of horticulture and, you know, the ecological benefit of it. So it's kind of some of the things that Roy Diblick has done and others. And it's like the way gardens are trending. I think you all had Kelly Norris on, you know, that's one of the things that a lot of horticulturalists are starting to think about. How can they make a difference with their plantings by having more native plants, but then having more native plants where people don't, you know, people like aesthetically appreciate it for its beauty, but then also learn about its biodiversity and all the effect, all the positive effects it have. And they don't think of it as like unkempt, if you will.
Yeah, mine tends to look a little unkempt at times. I probably could do a better job if I took your advice on that a little bit more, Mark. Oh, my goodness. Well, Pat in Duluth, Minnesota has something for us, a comment. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I love the program. I heard Chalamy speak within the last half year. And he gave a 30% number of the plants in our yard that would not have to be native. So if people had a lilac or something that they loved, you know, like an heirloom plant from family or that. So that 30% means that if a person wanted to try the nativars but have, you know, 70% native, that might be a way to go.
Yep. I've heard the same thing. Like Doug's study of the Carolina chickadee, they found that, you know, your yard needed to have 70% of its biomass be native plants in order for that chickadee to actually be able to successfully rear its young. So that's where his number comes from. But it's so important because it's a first like quantitative idea that you would know in your yard of what you needed to plant. So thanks for bringing that up. That's a really important point. And the other thing that I think about it is it's like 70% of the biomass. So like you could have an oak tree, which is native, which has a huge amount of biomass and perhaps still have, you know, all more of your ornamental perennials and things on the ground. So that's like the hard part of it to me, from what I understand of the study, you know, to quantify. But it's something that actually at Green Bay Botanical Garden, we're trying to figure out, like we want to tag all of our plants with either nativar or ornamental plant. And then we'll probably have to have another field that says like the size of the plant or the biomass so that we could, you know, tell our visitors someday how much of our collection or how much of our gardens are natives and see if we're meeting that requirement to be, in essence, you know, a sustainable, better steward of the area that we take care of as Green Bay Botanical Garden.
That is really cool. I love that. You know, you mentioned oaks, and oak trees are magnificent source for insects, birds, mammals. I mean, I was trying to think of, I'm trying to picture oak trees in the Green Bay Botanical Garden. I know they're there, so.
yeah, you're right, man. We have like Doug's work and the different ones. Like the National Wildlife Federation has a place, like Plant Finder, where you can like type in and you learn how many caterpillars and insects use it for food. And like you said, the oak tree is like the huge one, 500 plus. So at the Botanical Garden, we have a lot of northern pin oaks, you know, which have seeded and been throughout the grounds, and that King Shea Garden is surrounded by them. And there's somewhere they're like in a line where it's almost like they were planted or maybe left, you know, on purpose to be a line of oak trees. So those are our big ones that are our grandpa plants out there providing habitat.
David in North Freedom, we'll go to you now. Hi, David.
Yeah, I noticed, you know, we're talking about gardens, but the lawn is also pretty important. I noticed a couple of years ago the bumblebees were hitting plantain flowers, and I went online and looked up. It said that protein in plantain pollen is very, very high. And, I mean, the bees are hitting it hard. So it's important to also look at what you have in your lawn besides grass.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
a good
point
there, David.
Yeah, you know, I think there was an article in the American Gardener a little while ago that was talking about just what you're saying, David, how, you know, like maybe you shouldn't worry so much about all the weeds in your lawn because it's actually more diversity than just the turf grass part of it, you know. And some of that ties to like us being able to like live with insects eating on our plants. It's like our idea of what is pretty or aesthetically pleasing maybe should change slightly to increase that habitat. And the other thing it made me think about, David, was how, you know, turf grasses or turf used to have the clover and the different things like that as part of it, you know, so it was more diverse kind of, and it had, you know, that was like pollen for, you know, bees and things like that. So maybe don't worry so much about the weeds in your turf grass, right?
Well, I tell you, and actually there's a little bit of a trend coming back now to bring in some of the clover, for example, in some of the mixes, because the clover does, you know, it also provides nitrogen, but it's a great, you know, for the insects. And I've mentioned this in the past, or somebody else mentioned it in the past, even Creeping Charlie, which a lot of people hate, it's the first thing to bloom in the spring. And so you go out, if you've got Creeping Charlie, you go out in the spring when that's flowering, and that's practically the only thing flowering, and there's insects all over the Creeping Charlie. So even it provides a benefit to our insects. David, thank you so much. Jennifer in Oshkosh, let's go to you. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you, Larry and Mark, for taking my call. I have probably a 5x5 rock garden out in the front, and I have Siberian irises planted on either corners, which I like the symmetry of that. But this year they have like had runners that kind of took over and popped up all over. Am I going to have to dig up all of those? And it's kind of intertwined with some of my other plants in my rock garden, so I'm afraid of damaging some of those. Any advice?
Was it your Siberian iris you said that's kind of spread over?
Yeah, they're Siberian irises, and I call them runners, but they're just kind of like popping up throughout my whole rock garden. And I try to take some out pretty gently without disturbing some of my other perennials that are in there. And they're just really, they took over this year as like popping up throughout the entire rock garden. And I'm just kind of wondering, do I have to take up the main plants, or I'm just trying not to disturb too much of the, I like the symmetry and the different heights that I have, and just looking to not have to take all of them out.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I haven't heard of a Siberian iris going that crazy, but yeah, I think you could do like you've been doing, is like teasing them apart, but that would be a lot of work and challenging. The other idea I kind of had that may or may not be helpful is to, if you're willing to use, you know, like a broad herbicide, to like just paint those things with it, you know, instead of like going crazy, because you probably have a lot of good plants all amongst there. Or sometimes Melinda Myers always likes to say use of like a milk jug or something is like a cone to protect where you're spraying, and just use that to spray the part of it that you want to. But I feel like, you know, like having to kind of like dig it out with a soil knife or something would be, you know, unfortunately, your best bet, just more work. I don't know. What do you think, Larry?
Well, I'm surprised that you're getting that kind of spread from a Siberian iris, to be perfectly. Are you sure it's a Siberian iris, Jennifer?
Siberian irises that I bought 5 years ago from the Pain and Plant Art Center when we had our plant sale. We're members there, and I thought, oh, they're so pretty, and they're long and slender, and they're have that dark purple, which I like the contrast of color to some of the yellows and the brown-eyed Susans that I have in the rock garden as well. But just within this last year, all these little shoots just started popping up all over, and it's the same leaf, and even one had started to have the bud of like what the Siberian iris is. So I'm fairly certain that they're like little offshoots of these Siberian irises. So, and I hadn't had this with other iris plants either, but I don't know if it just really loved the soil there this past year or what was going on. So, I just didn't want to disturb all of the other plants, of course, but I like the idea of the broadband spray, you know, the broadleaf spray, I should say. I think that might be a give a go try here for me, I think.
Yeah, with a paintbrush or something like that.
Yeah, something to keep it from going on all your other good plants, but that's, you know, worth a shot to save you some time and energy maybe. Or maybe you'll have to dig them up and sell them back to the paint.
There you go. Oh, man. Thanks, Jennifer. Appreciate the call very much. Well, you know, I want to go back, Mark, to events that you've got going on. You've got your and talk about that again for a minute, because there's something coming up Saturday weekend.
Yeah, the winter celebration, free admission. Come on out to Green Bay Botanical Garden and see the winter landscape. You'll be able to kind of walk around there, scavenger hunt. There's a take-home activity for children, and you get a chance to get outside in the warmish winter. We have this pollinator pop-up later in February, weather pending, because we have what we have is like snow. We make these big blocks of snow where we actually take sheets of plywood and strap them together and pack snow into them for the snow carvers. And then we're going to have them come and do some sculptures for us, hopefully in the end of February, if we get enough snow up here in Green Bay. And that's kind of a really neat activity where you can come to the botanical garden, see some of these snow sculptures. We call it the pollinator pop-up. So people still think about pollinators in the cold months of February. And a chance to kind of see some of this snow art at the botanical garden.
Well, I tell you what, we got a little snow in southern Wisconsin. Some people would probably be happy to send your way, Mark, because there seems to be plenty here, that's for sure. Well, listen, it's been a great pleasure. You always bring so much enthusiasm and joy to the show, and I really appreciate you being with us. And congratulations to the Green Bay Botanical Garden for 25 years in 2021. And I'm sure we'll be talking with you or some other folks from the Botanical Garden as we go through the year. Thank you, Mark.
You bet. Thank you, Larry. And thank you so much for having us and celebrating Green Bay Botanical Garden. Thanks for all your part of being part of Green Bay Botanical Garden over the years. We appreciate it, sir.
Maybe there's a photo of me at that talk. I looked a lot younger then, and I was a lot younger when I gave that speech at that banquet. Oh, man. Mark Conlock, our guest today, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. It's great to have him with us. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll be talking about taking care of orchids and other indoor plants, so I hope you can join us for that. Monday at 11, we'll have the dean of the UW-Madison Business School to talk about how business education is changing to keep pace with the time. That's on Monday. And don't forget, sign up for the PBS Wisconsin Garden and Landscape Expo and sign up. Just go online, sign up for it, register before the 31st, and you may have a chance for a personal visit with me for 15, 20 minutes or so. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.